What's up, everybody? State of Man. I'm John.
This is James.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Thomas.
And you're listening to
BBS Radio.
Check out www.stateofmanmusic.com.
Dude, nobody does the www anymore, man.
Yes, they do.
It's not about the WW, Gary. It's about
the BBS, baby.
BBS.
Make sure to check out both sides of the story, our new CD at stateofmanmusic.com.
Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have back on the show Dr. Joyce Kovelman, who is the author of Crimes Against Humanity, A1, H1, W2. This is a very interesting book. It's a book of fiction, but carries with it a warning about possibilities if we don't have more responsibility as guardians of the earth, and especially in adventures into biological warfare arena. Joyce has two PhDs, one in anatomy and one in psychology, and she has served for many years as an official ECOSOC representative to the United Nations on behalf of the Institute of Global Education. And Joyce's book is a really wonderful book in terms of a work of fiction, but also I learned a great deal about microbiology and some of the things that I never knew about. So I was very happy to read the book and happy to have her on the show. Welcome, Joyce.
My pleasure to be here. I hope we can interest people in what I've written about and what is so important to the world today.
So, what got you interested in writing fiction? I know that we interviewed you before on the show on nonfiction, but what was it that led you in this direction?
Well, I really think the idea sort of was developing over years. And what I decided was that a novel is interactive, and that means that the reader, whether versed in science or mathematics or weaving cloth, whatever their expertise is, will interact, embrace, and be influenced by the various characters of a book. And we grow up as children with fairy tales and poetry like Jack and Jill Fell Down the Hill. And I really felt that this was a way for them to not only get the left brain, but also the right brain feeling emotions. There are characters you like. There are those you despise. You can feel their pain. You can feel and share their ecstasy. You can see maybe deceit. So I felt that this was a better integrated experience, particularly for people who are not the converted scientists who either agree or deny what I'm writing about.
It's very interesting that the book is really about, at the core of the book, it's about marine biology. I, for years, wanted to be a marine biologist. My uncle was involved in NOAA during the environmental years of the 70s, and so my whole family was involved in environmental issues. I think that marine biology for me represented something very important in terms of the ecology of the earth, because so much of the world is ocean, and I don't think people really realize how much the marine biology environments, when they're out of whack, how that can affect the entire earth. And perhaps we got a little taste of that during the Gulf oil crisis.
Right, and there's one in Alaska. We have a lot of ocean crises that are man-made. And what I was surprised to find is that the oceans cover 70 to 75% of our planet. And with global warming and melting of ice, it's not unreasonable to know that there's going to be a greater water coverage by oceans and lakes and stuff, because we're going to lose our coastlines, which are one of the richest farmlands, though presently somewhat depleted. So really, our oceans are very important. And I once saw something when I was in Disney World on the east coast of Florida, and I was waiting for someone to pick me up, and I saw that the oceans, as well as our atmosphere, biosphere, they really work together. They are not detached. They are very much dependent on each other. And so when global warming and climate change began and polar things began to melt, I began to see that connection even more. And I think it's very important that before we destroy our oceans, we begin to work with nature, not against nature, because nature really knows what she's doing and has done a pretty credible job until the last 30, 40 years.
Now, one of the very interesting things in your book is the introduction of the single-celled microorganism. Let me see if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Archaea, is that right?
Archaea, probably.
Archaea, okay.
Yeah.
Archaea, I wasn't really aware, even though I'm a biology major, I wasn't really aware that this is one of the three domains on the tree of life: archaea, bacteria, and eukarya. I guess we're eukarya, right?
We're humans. Along with, believe it or not, fungus.
Fungus, yeah. Everything like above fungus, okay?
Yeah.
And so is that, where do plants come in?
Plants are sort of, they're there with bacteria, but they're a different breed, but they are on the tree. You know,
okay.
I'm not sure I can give you exactly where, but they came before we did. And so when we kill the plants and we deplete the soil, we're really depleting our future and the promise of that future to ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren. So we need to be very careful what we're doing to the entire planetary system, because it's all integrated.
It sure is. So this is one of the three branches on the tree of life, the archaea. Archaea. Archaea?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes,
would you like to explain a little bit more about what some of the characteristics of these single-celled organisms and where they live and what role they can play in the ecology of the ocean?
Well, they play a very important, fundamental, foundational basis role in life on the planet, any kind of life. And they may have been the first place where chemistry turned into biology and began to create life. Archaea is a one-cell organism. They used to be confused with bacteria because they work so much with bacteria. They work with viruses. What you see under the ocean is that everything is cooperating with everything. So Archaea was given its own branch and own species only in 1988. And also one of the things is we never had the submersible vessels that we have now, where a scientist or engineer can go to the very depths of the earth in the water and do some exploration, discovery, so forth. We never could get down until maybe the last 20 years, 30 years, and it's rather sophisticated now. So we're learning actually more about the sea, about archaea, and even the other one. So bacteria and archaea work in splitting nitrogen, which is important to the sea creatures of every kind and on every level from the depth to the surface of the ocean. They're really very much in demand. Most of them don't cause any real infection, except that in this book, which is a mystery thriller whodunit, there is one species that does get out of control, and that's what the story is about. I'd like to add one other thing. Recently, just the week the book was published in August, they discovered and announced the discovery of a giant virus, which is also one cell. It's actually not a complete cell. The virus invades human cells, animal cells, mammal cells, fish cells, and then they take over the organism to make you sick if it's a illness-producing organism. Well, they found a fourth potential putative tree of life branch. And they're following that. So there's more surprises ahead now that we have submersibles. Just last week, they discovered a very large cavern underneath the sea, 2 miles deep. And that's like the Grand Canyon. They never knew it was there. So as we go down, we're learning more not only about bacteria and viruses, but about this separate, different third tree of life. But we're also seeing that they're all cooperative. And what they do is they live mostly in the dark, and they do not need oxygen to survive and thrive. They need things like carbon, nitrogen, sulfur, and they are able to go to what they call extreme environments. So they're extremophiles is what they call. They love those environments, whether it's salty, like the one I use in the book, AHW, Archaea, Hollow, Quadra, Wildly, and that's its name. So it's easier to say AHW. And they also like extreme heat at the gas vents at the bottom of the sea. And that's where chemistry probably started to become biology, where things, molecules came together to create the life forms that eventually led to our evolution. So they're very important, and they live in the extremely hot, the extremely cold, and the extremely salty environments in the ocean.
I have a question. Well, this would explain why I never heard of them, because I was well out of school by 1988, so it wasn't in any biology text that I ever read. My question is, have they been discovered in any other environment than the ocean, like in the salt beds of Utah or in volcanic environments?
I think they would. I definitely didn't study that because I was looking at the ocean. And there are quite a lot of volcanoes in the ocean, including right in Antarctica, where the story begins. So I would imagine that some of those really hot, salty, like the salt beds and stuff, I would imagine that they would be found there. They are found in waterways throughout the world, but they are specific to Antarctica, the polar region, and wherever there are these extreme environments, which is towards the bottom of the sea.
And then I have another question. Just in general, we're going places we've never gone before because we have equipment that can get us there, especially deep sea exploration. Do you think there's any danger, just like going to the moon or going to Mars, that we might pick something up that could be pathogenic to humans so that we would have to have the same kind of care that the astronauts have coming back in? You know, they go through all sorts of decontamination and quarantine before they are released. Do you think that's also necessary
I think it's necessary. And I think that there's begun to be awareness of that. And that is part of one of the plots in the book.
Right.
Where you have to be careful what you're doing to the very fragile, interconnected different environmental and sub-environmental systems that would work together. We're putting pollutants. We're having oil spills, as you mentioned. We're depleting things. We're just doing terrible things to the bottom of the ocean and all of it. And we are responsible. And I had two men who endorsed the book. And while they were reading it, when they finished it, they told me they cried. And for a man, even in today's world, to say that they cried openly is unusual. And I asked them what it was in the book that made them cry. And both of them said to me, I have children. I hope to have grandchildren in a number of years. And, you know, when I realize what we're doing to the oceans with all our toxic spills, our pollutants, our plastic, and even a lot of that is filled with germs that we're putting down, there's mutations that can happen. And they said, I'm worried about, is there a world that my children and grandchildren will want to inherit with all of this? So we might create that very different kind of disease you're talking about. It might not exist, but we might help it evolve with some of these toxic materials. So I think we need to use the beware.
Yeah, I spent a great deal of time studying ecology, environmental, especially marine biology, and I agree that it is a very delicate balance, and I think your book shows that in a very dramatic way, that the wrong move or going down the wrong path can actually and especially when governments are deliberately going down the wrong path, trying
That's
to
right.
create pathogenic species for biological warfare. It's just very, very dangerous. And I think that was the impression that I got when I read the book, was that this is a warning about how fragile that environment is, and how cavalier man has been about messing with it. So,
well, we go down to take the treasures of the sea, and we think it belongs to us. And it is easier to mine for certain rare metals, for example, down at the bottom of the ocean than it is in any mine. And we really have to be mindful that we are possibly changing with the chemicals we leave behind and the destruction of some of these very fragile environmental systems, that we are changing the environment. And that also makes us a polluter and a plunderer. And that's what the book really is meant to show. It's a very good story.
Yeah.
There are lots of very interesting characters. You like some, you hate some, but they're real people. And there are also a lot of stories in there, relationships of love and hate and deceit and violence. And that's what makes the book something that people will remember and relate to. And we have to now begin to relate to these economic systems that are all interrelated and interdependent before it's too late.
Yeah,
so
that's
true. Part of what I wrote about. And I'm really amazed because I started to write this book a number of years ago and then put it aside, and it was only about 5 months of writing after that because the book was developing within my psyche. And I really am amazed that since August, when the book came out, maybe a little sooner, there has been articles about the ocean, about what we're doing to it, the fragile ecosystems on the internet, in journals of scientific endeavor, as well as just in your newspaper. I have never seen as much, and they are aware of the decline, and the oceans are dying. It's inescapable. They are dying, and we even don't know about most of it. And we have to stop thinking that we arrogantly own the sea, and we own the land, and we own the sky. It's nature's. And this is what commits us to live, and we need to work with instead of against. That's one of the things in the book, because things are getting more and more fragile, even as we talk.
Yeah, there's plenty of movies coming out of Hollywood for a number of years now showing the results of such cavalier behavior, worlds where things are very, very tough. And so, there is something in the subconscious of the humanity that understands that if we are very greedy and short-sighted that we may create a world that's very difficult to live in. You know, the Mad Max series, and the, you know, there's many different movies of what could be. I wanted to mention, and I don't think you mentioned this in your book, but it occurred to me that all of the radioactive barrels that we toss into the ocean also may completely change genetics. You know, radioactivity once it becomes, you know, once it escapes those barrels or is escaping the nuclear power plants in Japan, has a great ability to change DNA. And, you know, I mean, that would be something that could rapidly change microorganisms.
Well, as the oceans are coming into more awareness, at least among the converted scientists and marine biologists, oceanographers, we are beginning to see what's happening. But the articles are telling us in the newspaper that we're not getting the full story on Fukushima.
No,
and
we're not.
It's far worse than we think. And so I have stopped eating fish from the Pacific because they're swimming back and forth between, you know, Japan and between the West Coast. And they're bringing back and forth this radioactive material. And this is very worrisome. Most people are not talking about the after effects. They're just talking about more radiation. It's a very trying situation.
So which fish are in the Atlantic Ocean?
The fish would be codfish, halibut. There's the Norwegian and Irish salmon. Those are the larger fish. They also have sharks. They have the crabs and lobster. Maine lobster is wonderful. Australia has its lobster on where they're near the Atlantic. It's really all connected. If you follow with your finger on a map, you will see that most of these waterways, the large ocean and seas, are really just interspersed with all the continents and islands and atolls. But it's really one ocean with these different massive continents between them, among them, actually. So it's really much more connected than we realize. And I think we saw some of that with the Gulf of Mexico and down into the ocean from there. And we're still fighting that pollution. We're still lost coral. We're losing a lot of fish. And if you read the paper again, as I do, because of my interest in the oceans, there are fish that are dying every day. There are dolphins dying thousands at a time. Some of them actually froze in Norway. Sardines actually froze. And the water was so cold that this whole school of fish actually was escaping one cold place and walked in, you know, swam into another and died. So we are losing sea life, even without some of the plots that I talk about, which are indeed happening on our planet. These are daily occurrences. It's not something like sci-fi could help happen. And then when you talk about genetics, we become much more aware of genetic altered food molecules and particles. I mean, if you look at something that says real chicken or real eggs, I mean, what is real food? Well, I think we are also not only with what we're doing to the environment of the ocean and changing it, and that can cause illness, as we've already said. We also have to look at genetic engineering, one-cell organisms and other disease-polluting organisms in the ocean, some of which we put there, and this radiation. What is that going to do to the foods we eat in the ocean?
Yeah, it's really quite dangerous. I know that a lot of the seafood in the Gulf, and I think also off of Vietnam, has high levels of arsenic in it. Have you heard that?
I've heard that, and you can't.
So that's
really
something to be careful about.
So many articles. So, you know, and I've gone into some California restaurants, and they have fish. Some are a fish restaurant. Mm-hmm. And some just have certain dishes that are seafood. And I ask them where the fish comes from. And, you know, most of them, waitresses have to go back and find out. And even they mm-hmm. are not necessarily told where they're
the
coming
truth,
from
yeah.
because they
yeah.
really know we won't find it otherwise. So what I hope with the book is to make them aware that whether it's a one-cell organism or a dolphin or a shark or a lobster, all of these do affect our daily life, and mm-hmm. that as we change that with our arrogance and really our lack of humbleness that nature knows better, we're really looking forward to possibly a lot of life dying. I mean, there's a lot that's being extinguished now and just off the face of the earth in the forests, in the air, and so forth. But just as we look at the atmosphere like the flu, this could happen from the ocean and not necessarily what was normally there, but what we helped create with our ignorance and our arrogance.
Yeah. Well, that actually is the way nature works, though. If you
yes.
Study nature, which you do in ecology, the aggressors are often retaliated against by nature, with the microorganisms being the weapon. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that theme plays again and again, that if there are very an overabundance of predators, then something happens and those predators get disease. So that that does happen in terms of just the way these things play out, and there's always balance. That's the message of the environmental ecology, is that there's a balance of everything, and if one thing gets out of balance, something else rises up to put it back in balance. So
right now,
world out of balance is what they call us. You know, the humans are way out
mm-hmm.
of balance. And so it's very possible that something like a virus will come along and put us back in balance. You know,
they just found
very, very possible.
Giant virus. They found only two examples of this. It's the first two that they've ever seen, one off the coast of Chile in 2003, only once. And then there was one just this year off of Melbourne's coast in Australia. They don't
mm-hmm.
know enough about it, but this could have changed even with just the garbage that's going into the sea. So we
mm-hmm.
have a responsibility to our children and our grandchildren, et cetera. And I go around the world with something that I got from Kenya, but there are many indigenous people who say this: take good care of the earth. It was
mm-hmm.
not given to you by your parents. It was lent to you by your children.
Right.
And that puts a different form of responsibility, again, on humankind. And I think some of the things that are trying to happen in the entire world today is to really make this a better place to live, to start taking care of animals, start taking care of birds. A lot of the flu comes where birds are caged, and they're not only
mm-hmm.
so crowded, but that's where, if disease starts, it rapidly spreads. We have to learn to take care of all of these organisms in the world, big, small,
mm-hmm.
flying, creeping, crawling, swimming, because they do affect us, and we affect them. And it is an exchange. It's an interaction. And again, that goes back to why write a book, why write a story, because I'm hoping that people will remember the
mm-hmm.
message and relate to certain characters long after they read the book.
Yeah, it is important for awareness of this whole ecosystem. One of the things, I did an interview last week on Scalar Energy and brought up, there was a book I read, I think it's Atlantis and the Neanderthals. Anyway, in the book, there's a machine that they discovered back with the Neanderthals that could cut huge granite pieces, and
mm-hmm.
could also, the Chinese are currently using it to desalinate water,
And it also is capable of neutralizing radioactivity. So,
fabulous.
Yeah. So there is technology, and we believe it's with the use of scalar energy, which would make sense because it has to be something multidimensional. But anyway,
right.
So there's some technology available that does all these amazing things, and it has been around for a very long time, probably coming from Atlantis. So this technology was rediscovered. I believe it was a Polish scientist that rediscovered it, and he was sold it to the Chinese, who used it for desalination, or at least a part of it. And then he was going to work in the U.S., but things fell out, and he didn't work here. So basically, you know, what I'm proposing is scalar energy can be used, the scalar energy devices can be used to neutralize radiation coming out of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be something that would be,
awesome.
Really important, because I don't know about you, but I've been reading some of the predictions of scientists saying that this is going to get out of hand to the extent that it could affect life all over the planet. You know, there's a possibility.
Right. Well, we're killing the plants that came before us, both in the ocean and out of the on land. And if we kill the plants and we kill the oceans and we infect the air even more, what will there be left that's safe to eat? And as we have more land under the sea. So it really begs a lot of questions, and we really are running out of time. There's a woman who's a marine biologist, Sylvia Earle, and she's just written some articles about, hey, guys, we're running out of time. And to me, the oceans are as close to another world. We talk about the moon Europa at Jupiter and Saturn. They have moons that may actually have water oceans. Some may have methane oceans. So maybe we'll find archaea at the hot geothermal vents at the mantle of these moons. But we really have, to me, one reason I picked Antarctica is that it is a very unique environment, as close to living on another moon or planet than we could get to at this point. And I don't think that humanity is going to get very far in the universe in travel until we learn to control our appetite for all these different things that we can mine from the ocean or from the land or put into the atmosphere. So I really think that Antarctica is as close to another planet, and it's quiet, and there's not industry there. There's just research labs and some military bases. And it really does also, like with the all the alien pictures and this gravity and the moon and stuff, that really tickles humankind's fancy. But so did the oceans, particularly now that we can go to the bottom of the sea. I mean, we're finding volcanoes. As I said, we're finding this new Grand Canyon that they announced about a week ago. There's so much treasure there, but we have to find it before we pollute and decimate it.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem. In your book, you talk about under water, or especially under the ocean, mining operations. And I don't think the public really realizes how much chemicals are used in mining.
That's right. And the ones who are mining are not taking responsibility for leaving mud behind, covering up these different organisms that dwell there and help extract all this treasure from the mantle of the ocean, of the planet. And so really, they're killing the golden goose that's feeding them, if you will. And that's not a good idea even for their needs, let alone the planet. But we must begin to realize that the planet is a living, breathing organism. And Bolivia has already given Mother Nature back her rights as a planet and to be taken care of and not to be plundered or exploited. That's the first nation on our planet that has done that. It's about 4 or 5 years already.
Really?
Yeah, Bolivia. And they have an indigenous president. And he's the one that got that passed through their parliament or their political houses. Yes, it's a beginning. And I think that we're moving towards that. But we're also right now moving behind. And when you have, when you're giving birth to a baby, you first kind of contract and you build up energy. And that allows you to push the baby through the birth canal. And so I see some of these things are really bringing attention to where we need to work and learn. And we've all evolved. That's change. We've all changed in response to our environment. So whether we live in survival, we become something different. We're doing that to ourselves indirectly.
True.
Yeah, so it's a big thing, and I'm really surprised at how many articles come out every month now.
Well, I think the awareness of it is coming up because we need to do something about it. And I guess, you know, I mean, do you feel that you've worked with the UN? Do you feel that we have a viable option in some international organization like the UN to get things done?
Yes. And the reason I say that is that there's a lot of science and there's a lot of current information, things happening in the ocean. It's not all good and it's not all bad. It's combinations of both. And the UN has created a committee, a department for people who want to mine for whatever the elements at the bottom of the sea or in the mantle that sometimes rises up from the seabed. And so they have given the permission to the First Nation to go down to certain areas and mine for these treasures. I don't want to give the treasures away. I want them to be surprised in the book when they come to those ideas and not give away the plots too soon. But the first country is China. They went down this past May. And they will now, they're also not only getting permission to go certain ways, they went down to the west coast of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean, okay? And there are countries that are losing the battle to go down and get some of the goodies because they don't have the funds to get submersibles and go down to the bottom of the ocean. So that's causing a lot of political angst for those who don't have versus the ones who are exploring and gaining the treasure. So that's like what's happening on Earth is now beginning to happen on the seafloor. And there are actually countries putting their flags down on the bottom of the seafloor, like I own this. The UN doesn't support that, but that's already happening. And the Sylvia Earle is asking for really parks or reservations of parts of the seafloor that cannot be touched by very arrogant, humans that are destroying. She's asked for that. So there's a lot of things going on under the sea, okay? And right now we're in rough seas, but I hope that we can begin to turn that around just like we have to do in the air and on land.
Yeah, my uncle was a diplomat, and he was one of the first diplomats into China when China was opened up under Nixon. And he used to tell me all about the battles that went on with the fishing rights, as you know.
Yeah.
That was going on back then. But now that battle, I guess, is now more to mine the ocean floor. You know, the fishing treaties have been done, but now we're going deeper.
Yeah, and I find that a very metaphorical analogy because we're going into the depths. We're going into the dark. We're going where oxygen is in there. These creatures, big and small, down at the heat in these extreme environments that we thought nothing could live. They're not only living there, but they're creating life anew. What they extract from the mantle is not just rare metals and things like that. They're also getting food and metallic particles to the other kinds of fish and sea life that depend on it. And then we depend on that growing and eating if it's safe. So it's all integrated. It's all dependent, and we are part of the web of life, which is another word for the tree of life. And what we do to that tree, we do to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes in weird ways that we don't understand, because we don't understand the interrelationships yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's an important book, not because I wrote it. I wrote it because it's an important issue that we have to become aware.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are three different areas that I am very interested as the next frontier or even the now time for discovering. One is the inner mind, what the consciousness, mm-hmm. what the self is.
Right.
And each of us walks around with our part of that environment. And then we have the oceans, which may help us find where we could maybe land in the universe in other places. And then mm-hmm. the third one, so it's the mind, it's the oceans, and it's the universe and all that it contains, so that we can explore. And part of humankind is to explore. So
right.
That's part of our nature. And we do evolve, like it or not, but we can help make the involvement the way we want it to be, not the way we forced it to become.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me is this third branch on the tree of life wasn't discovered until 1988. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about that. We didn't even know it existed. What else don't we know exists? The giant viruses?
That's right. Well, we know it exists times two. That's not enough in science to say it exists. But is that there naturally? Is that there because of radiation?
Right.
Is that there because of genetic mutation?
Mutation, right.
Yeah. And so
the giant viruses, what were they found in? What were they found? I mean, I know where they were found, but were they found? Do you have any more information about what they were found, the environment they were found in?
There's only two articles that I found, because I haven't gone and followed it through yet. I haven't found others, but they have been found off the coastlines of those two countries of Chile and Australia at Melbourne. And they only have those two examples. And they do not know yet if it causes illness. I think they think it's particularly likely. But they know so little, but they have at least now two reports of this. Now, did it spontaneously come about because of pollution, or
mm-hmm.
because we've gone lower into the earth, that it's moved around, it's been, you know, tossed around with all the commotion now and the moving of submersibles? We don't know the answers. All we know is we've seen it twice.
Well, was it in what kind of cells were the viruses found in, or were they found outside of cells?
No, they were found in the water.
Okay, so they weren't invading anything yet. Okay.
Not yet. Not yet.
Okay.
So it's a new area opening up, and a new responsibility for humankind,
mm-hmm.
and for them bringing forth a world that will continue to support not only our life and lifestyles, but also that of many of the sea creatures and even the rest of us that depend on the sea. Because, as I said, the ocean and the atmospheres are very connected. And there was an incredible film that I have never found again, but shows how if there's a storm in the atmosphere, there's something going on beneath the waves of the sea.
Mm.
They're connected. And I never forgot that. So I think it's not only an important issue, which is why I wrote it, and it is based on things already true. It's not just sci-fi, but there is some sci-fi, particularly towards the end of the book when I conclude the story. But it's also a good story. There are interesting characters. There are double
mm-hmm.
agents. There's a crime spree out of control. So, and I'm told that there's even a potential for some movies. And now that we can go down under the ocean, maybe that will happen. I would love to have that happen, because we're a visual being. All humans are more visual than anything else. So if we see it, it really makes us feel part of it, and we begin to believe whether we like it, what's happening or not, and we begin, I think, to take the responsibility once we really believe it's happening. And things are going to change, whether we do it or not. It's going to change because we put it into motion. So humanity has the greatest responsibility right now to start working with nature, as I say, rather than against it.
Yeah, I think it would make a great movie. Just the storyline and also the message that the book has is very, very important.
Right.
It really is. Have you seen pictures of the blue ice in Antarctica?
Yes, I've seen pictures. It's striking. They're just incredible pictures, but I've also seen the melting of this blue ice and stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought they were just amazing. I ran across a photographer at out at the Stone Mountain Daisy Fair, the big fair out at Stone Mountain. I ran into him out there, and he had pictures of the blue ice, and I thought about you in the book when I was looking at these fabulous photographs of blue ice in Antarctica.
Well, you know, we are talking a lot about the Arctic, and that's important. It's part of the subsystems that are connected, and it's happening at least visibly more readily in the world today. But I don't see very much except once in a while, like the blue water or a melting thing. We don't talk about Antarctica that much, although it's beginning. And actually, those two polar regions work together. So I got into this, and I'm into it big time, I guess. And I can see writing more about these different creatures of the sea and the different happenings, which are increasingly faster and faster, which means time's running out.
Yeah, I think you need to do your next book on the effect of the radiation, since that's what's pouring into the ocean right now.
That's right.
That's that awareness needs to come up.
That's right. Remember 3 Mile Island?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we built the nuclear plants on our coastal water, by the water.
We always build it by water. Isn't it necessary to have water for a nuclear plant? I think it is.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, it is because of meltdown and stuff like that. But we're also getting, as Fukushima proved to us, you know, and Fukushima, I mean, they didn't create the earthquake and the tsunami, but they sure do not have yet a way to totally stop what's happening.
There needs to be some sort of a fail-safe method of shutting it down before the tsunami or the earthquake reaches the thing. I mean, within seconds, they need to be able to shut it off.
That's right. Well, they're learning that. I know that when I used to drive by one of the nuclear plants between L.A. and San Diego in California, I just watched myself, and I got a little faster as I drove through that nuclear zone with the plant. I didn't do it consciously, but on some level, I sort of raced through that area without getting a ticket, and because I was aware of the problems.
I bought something on Amazon that people need to know about. It's called a Nuke Alert. It's it's about 1.5 inches by 2 inches, and you can just put it on your keychain. And it, I think it's about $180. It's not real expensive. I know it's less than $200. And it will beep when you're near radioactivity. It beeps very quickly if it's a high radioactivity. But I went ahead and put it under the fluoroscan here in the office, and it beeped like one beep every minute for a while. Because there's not a lot of radiation when you do a, you know, an X-ray with a fluoroscan, but there is some. So you for about $185 on Amazon, and I know they sold a lot of these in Japan. I mean, because there was a special thing on the website for Japanese instructions. Okay, but this is a lot easier to carry than is a Geiger counter, and you can just, like I said, put it on your keychain. And so if you're ever in an area where there's a potential for radiation, this device might alert you that something's radioactive. I think it's well worth getting. I mean, it's, you know, it's very safe. I mean, we just don't, this is my opinion, we just don't know what might be radioactive now. I mean,
that's right.
Probably not in Atlanta, Georgia, but certainly in California, or if you travel overseas,
right.
You don't know what is and is not radioactive, because I don't think the controls are there.
Yeah, well, you know, when you talk about radioactive and stuff, and there are these volcanoes right under the ice in Antarctica,
mm-hmm.
and it's sitting on the hot mantle of the Earth, you know, and you think, what would happen if one of those volcanoes under the sea went off? And that's
mm-hmm.
how my mind thinks, to get to plots and ideas, and it really is frightening. So I think people are getting aware of what we need to be aware of.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that radiation is going to be a very big issue under the sea.
Yeah, I think it
is
too. Yeah.
It already is. And it's showing that we're all connected. It's not just the sea creatures or these
mm-hmm.
one-cell organisms that really are at the bottom of the tree of life, which is fundamental to the rest of the tree. It's like, if you don't have roots, the tree isn't going to grow much longer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One-cell organisms like archaea, like bacteria, like even a giant virus, they are fundamental in some ways, whether it's predator-prey, keeping the balance. They are all connected in keeping them balanced. And you know what? I said it from the very beginning of this interview, that they cooperate. They work for the benefit of all these subsystems of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
We fight and plunder, and we have something to learn in that.
Yeah, and like we said before, the natural balance that occurs in ecology is that if something gets too aggressive, if something overgrows,
mm-hmm.
then something else comes along to destroy it. And usually that destruction involves, you know, the smaller things like viruses or bacteria or something, you know.
Right.
But that virus and bacteria was created to be pathogenic because the disbalance of what was created by the predator. You know, that's basically how things happen. So, you know, given that we know that how nature rebalances itself, we can pretty much understand what will happen. And it may just be something as stupid as our biological warfare agents getting out of control. You know, just basically something like that. Or the radiation causing some genetic mutation in something that we don't even know exists, like these giant viruses.
Exactly. Well,
so,
that may also be, that's nature's form of evolution.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's
nature is inherently
modify.
Intelligent.
That's right.
Inherently.
We need nature to do what she does well, and balance and harmony, then hopefully
that's right.
we'll find it within the human species as well. And
well, the aggressor doesn't do well. You know, the aggressor is then finds itself in the role of being a victim. You know, it's
right.
So that's
the creatures of the sea will rise up.
Yeah.
Let us know. So
Let
anyhow,
us know, right.
It's really an interesting idea, and I hope that people in reading the book with the characters and the plots,
mm-hmm.
I hope that they will feel it and really get in touch with it in a visceral way and keep the ideas with them long after they read the book and take some action.
Do you want to give some contact information, Joyce?
Yes, I am in Sylmar, California, S-Y-L. M-A-R, and my internet, if you want me to get anything by email and open it, please let me know what it's about so I will feel safe in opening it, is a soul1, spell it A-S-O-U-L, and the number one, a soul1 at AOL.com. That's the best way to reach me, and love to hear from the readers. Love to hear from people already involved in the submersibles. I'd like to go down one day. So love to hear from all of you, whether you've read the book or will or whatever. I'd like to hear your thoughts.
And if there's any screenwriters out there, take a look at the book and see if you can get ideas for the movie, because I think that that would be a great movie.
I think it would, and I think it would sort of make us more whole by including this water that covers and nurtures our planet big time. So we're a beautiful blue and white planet. We are a water planet, and it's time to begin to appreciate the role the oceans play in life and evolution.
Well, thank you, Joyce, for joining us. It's been a great conversation. Hope to have you back on.
Love to. And it was good to just talk with you, Susan. It was great.
Yeah. Well, we've been interviewing Dr. Joyce Kovelman, who is the author of Crimes Against Humanity, A1H1W2. Please read the book. It's a great, entertaining book, plus something that I think everybody on the planet needs to appreciate, basically the ecology and how the oceans are very, very important in for the health of the planet and humanity. Thanks for joining us, Joyce.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me. And let's see what readers will learn and do and help us with this incredible, vast domain of evolution.
Thanks a lot. Next week, we're going to be interviewing Timothy Wiley, Revolt of the Rebel Angels, The Future of the Multiverse. That should be good. And the next week is Susan Shumsky, Power of Auras, Tap into Your Energy Field for Clarity, Peace of Mind, and Well-Being. And thank you all for joining us. And join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.
I will.